Lunch with Leon.
Hello and welcome to another episode of Lunch with Leon. Thanks very much indeed for joining us today. So what have I been doing since we met last? I did this great thing for the EY Foundation, thanks to Anna Delvecchio at EY. We did this tremendous Dragon's Den. We had 30 young people from South London, and these young people, all still at school, spent some time with us. And one of the things we asked them about was how to make highways a career of choice. We got some tremendous feedback from those wonderful young people, all of whom had different ideas. Of course, it had plenty to do with social media and TikTok and video and all sorts of things. But several of them said that before they had any idea about this, for them, highways were just something that they took for granted, whether it's the pavement, whether it's the roads, how we use them, who uses them, and so on. And by the time they'd finished, they'd really thought about how to make highways more exciting and make them the sort of places where people would like to go and work. We've got a terrible skills shortage across the highway sector. Skills in terms of an aging workforce. Where are the people of the future coming from? And we have to attract young people because they all can't be social media influencers and they all can't be doing video games and computer games. We do need our young people really to come forward and do some of these, for me, are really exciting jobs in transport. I had the great pleasure to catch up with my old friend, Matt Ginsberg, who's normally resident in the US, working for Google across in California, but he was in London for a week. And we had some great conversations. Sadly, we didn't get a chance to have lunch. He's been a guest on this program before, but we had a fascinating conversation about, amongst other things, whether the progress that's now being made in certain parts of the world with drones, drones that can carry freight and drones that can carry passengers, might even mean that the whole autonomous vehicles thing will be superseded before it started. There's something to talk about. I'll have a word with Matt and see if you'd like to come back on the show and talk some more about that. And finally, on my travels, here's a piece of travel information. I had entirely forgotten as I came through Madrid airport last week that Terminal 4 is not even in the same town as Terminal 1, 2 and 3. It's further than you would be between Terminal 4 at Heathrow and Terminal 5 at Heathrow. It's a 15-minute bus ride in one direction or on a metro on the other. And if you have the misfortune, as I did, to be flying from the satellite of Terminal 4, that's another 15 minutes from Terminal 4 itself. So fortunately, I gave myself lots of time through Madrid airport. But of course, as is the case with these things, this beautiful Richard Rogers-designed palace, which is Terminal 4, in order to make it the size it is, it's had to be placed, frankly, a long way from the rest of the activity. So take my tip. If you're coming back to Madrid airport, if you've got a rental car to drop off, you've got to do that at Terminal 1, 2 and 3. Be prepared then for the walk, the wait, the bus ride, and then working your way all the way through Terminal 4. Enjoy Madrid airport the next time you're going through. So where does that bring us to? Well, of course, it's time for my guest on Lunch with Leon. Many of you will know my guest from her huge profile across at the London Assembly. My guest is Caroline Pidgeon, and she's been an elected member in public service for 26 years. She's been a long time on the London Assembly for the Liberal Democrats, and she is finally standing down at the next election. So it was my great pleasure to welcome Caroline on the show and to ask her what in particular she remembered her time on the London Assembly for.
Well, that's a really good question. Actually, when I look back, Leon, over 16 years, I just think how things have changed so much since I was on the Assembly. And some of the things we looked at very early on are just every day now. And I think that's really quite interesting. And I'm sure we'll discuss some of that in this podcast. But in terms of things I've achieved, when you're a scrutineer, it's quite hard to be able to put your finger on exactly what you achieve, because all mayors steal good ideas that you put forward and claim it as their own. But the things that are definitely, I can say, that was my action, the one-hour bus ticket, which I campaigned on for years and years and years. Boris always said he really liked it. He just couldn't afford to do it. Sadiq bought in the hopper fare. And to be fair, at my final mayor's question time, as well as saying some very nice things about me, he did kind of credit me that that was where the idea came from. So that's really good, which helps so many lower income Londoners, particularly when they change bus. And another really niche thing that I helped change, which took a lot of negotiation with government and TfL, was an obscure bylaw on the tube, which meant if you had a guide dog, you couldn't go on a moving escalator. And I think this dated back to when escalators were wooden and they would get hot and it would be hot on the dog's paw. And I was talking to a visually impaired campaign group when I got elected. And I said, well, what's the one thing that would make a difference? And they said, well, can you get this bylaw changed? Because the only way our users can use the escalator at a rush hour is if it's switched off and it becomes a staircase. And that's really stopping them using lots of stations on the tube. So I did a lot of work pushing Boris, pushing TfL and ministers in the DfT, and that was changed. And now, if you have a guide dog and you want to go on a moving escalator to get to the tube, you can. So small thing, but it will have helped a particular community.
That's amazing. That is, and you know, that's just the sort of thing. It sounds quite small, but in fact, it takes a huge effort, and the benefit is wider than anybody can possibly imagine, isn't it?
Yeah, and people don't. It's such a small thing, and you think, oh, I can do that very quickly. And you ask a question, and you realize, no, it's got to be changed here as well. But I just worked really hard with civil servants, with the minister at the time in the DfT, with Boris, and then we got the change. And that's a really satisfying moment where you think, I actually have made a difference. But over the years, I think I've done, I think we worked out nearly 5,000 bits of casework. So, I'm with TfL alone.
Yeah, in my time, you were my biggest casework.
I think at one point I was the equivalent of five assembly members worth of casework.
Were.
So I think that probably only went up. But that's great. That's what you're elected for, to represent people, to help them, but also pick up those trends. And I think that's one of the things I've tried to do over the years. People such as yourself, very senior at TfL, I only would go to you if I really thought, hang on, alarm bells, there's a trend here I'm picking up, I'm a bit worried about. Can you look into it? And I think then people listen because they respect you and think you only come to them when it really is something that is that serious. So.
Now, look, I agree with that, and I remember all sorts of things that we did. You were concerned, I remember, about double-decker buses on the 42 and the privacy of residents, and talking about privacy of residents, sightseeing buses parked outside people's homes in Waterloo and so on, all of which we were able to get resolved, weren't we? I mean,
Exactly.
the good thing on those times, and I hope it's still true now, I hope you felt there was a yes, we will if we can policy, as opposed to not unless you really, really make us. Because I often find with government, you get the latter. You
Yes.
know, you really have to work hard, and they really don't want to do it. And one of the reasons why I'm a great fan of local democracy is you get a much better relationship, I find, between the elected representatives and the agencies, because to some extent we're all in it together.
Yeah. And if you're working together for something and you pick up things and it just a small adjustment can really impact on people's lives or improve it, then you can put that and work together. What I slightly worry about is going forward, as budgets get tighter and tighter, the immediate reaction can be, no, we've got no money. When sometimes it's not about money, it's just about parking a bus in a different place or slight adjustments to a route, which actually may not cost anything but make a big difference. So, I just hope people keep that positive thinking and try to have that can-do attitude, because that's what makes a difference and improves the service for everyone.
Sure. We're not talking about London, but elsewhere in the country. I'm a great fan of local democracy, but it would be fair to say, wouldn't it? Democracy's not served us terribly well recently in terms of who gets elected into what sort of positions. I don't just mean in Britain, but perhaps in the United States of America and otherwise. So one of my worries is that as we push more and more local democracy, we need to find a way of making sure we get really top-class candidates to get elected into positions. Because I can't help feeling, as I say, when you look outside London in particular, some of the people who get elected are not quite the sort of people you want to be representing you. And there's a huge apathy in the local areas, and frankly, not a high caliber of candidates.
Well, I think it's increasingly hard to put yourself forward for election. I think it takes an awful lot because Look at social media now. Look at the pressure you're under. When I started, I was elected in 98 as a local councillor. And, I didn't have a council email even. I was a pilot member being on email after I'd been a councillor for 2 years. I had a post bag 3 times a week. I dictated all my casework. People look at me horrified now. They have no idea what it used to be like. And there is a real pressure, I think, on people now, particularly as a 24-hour society. I emailed you an hour ago. Why haven't you replied? Councillors are often given mobile phones now. So it's not an answer phone at home that you pick up several times a week and call people back. It's I left you a message. And I think that pressure is too much for some people. And people think, I don't need to do that. Of course, there's always the debate about elected members' pay. It's painful to be there. But when you look at what elected members do at different levels, they're not always remunerated in the right way, but that's, it's a toxic issue. Nobody can go near it. But I think one of the real issues is around, and this is that's a political issue, but around how we vote. And actually, if you had fairer votes, if you had some form of proportional representation, people feel their vote counts. And if you devolve far more things locally, I love the fact we have devolved government in London. I would love to have more devolution right across the country, across our city regions and so on, because I think then you feel you've got more of a say. And I want everywhere to look different, because actually what works for London's economy is going to be very different to what works for the northeast or the southwest, and allow innovation rather than constant constraints from government. And I think that we've seen in London where TfL has been out, led the way on ticketing. Look at the Oyster card, look at contactless. If TfL hadn't put contactless on the tube, and I was a skeptic at the time, and we had a lot of work, and we had Which magazine do some work for the assembly, and we said, well, these are concerns. People are nervous, the idea you can just tap your card. Isn't that what we all do now? We don't even carry cash. It's such a change. But TfL led that, absolutely led that. That mass transport network, being able to use your bank cards, that's changed everything. And I think you need to allow innovation in regions, and then actually people will be engaged. Give people a reason to vote, get people a reason to step forward. And I think that's where we need to see a big change in our country.
No, well, I agree with you, and the that innovation, and for me, there's always a slightly complicated problem, and it's a public sector, private sector problem. So I'm in the private sector, and I'm an innovator, and I've invented contactless payment, or I've invented tracking, or I've invented something. So I toddle off to my local agency, whether it's transport or anything else, and I say, "Here's my idea." And the agency says, "That's a really great idea. We're going to procure that." And all of a sudden, my ideas are in an invitation to tender, and my competitors are bidding against me. And I've given them the idea, and somebody else has got some work. And I think that's a real problem across the country, especially at the speed at which science is moving. It's very hard for clever people to invent things that would be good for society as a whole, and be able to get an agency to want to trial it or whatever, without tripping over the public procurement rules and broadly giving away their ideas. And I'm forever thinking about the sort of safe space that we need, where we can have those conversations, and we're not bound by EU procurement law anymore, but where we can have a safe space to have those innovation discussions, and for the inventors not to get cheated at the end of it,
Well,
because otherwise
I think
inventors won't do it.
it's really interesting, because one of the suggestions I put forward last year to the mayor and the commissioner at TfL, which the commissioner has taken forward, is around there's a huge increasing issue in London around tube noise. People are really sensitive to it. There are real issues. Rail grinding is one small solution, but it only works for a certain amount of time. And people, maybe it's because they've been working at home more and more, they're really sensitive to this. And that there are a limited number of solutions out there, which TfL have been trying. So I pushed Andy Lord, why don't you go out to the market, go out to academics, go out to institutions, and say, come forward with your ideas on different things that we could do, and then trial them, work with them, trial them, sort of an innovation hub. And that's exactly what they've done. So they've gone out to the market to try to see what's out there, get some ideas from people, and see who they can work with to try to solve these issues. Because it may be, I don't know, some small rubber little gadget that goes on here that solves some of the noise. Who knows? But actually, TfL hasn't got the money to spend researching it. There are people, as you say, with ideas out there. Put them together, try to. So I'm hoping if that works, that could become a model for some other issues across the transport network in the capital and beyond.
Yeah, I hope so because it's funny you should say that. On a plane journey I did relatively recently, when one of the cabin staff found out I was in transport, he told me he lived over the Victoria line near Stockwell, and what was I going to do about the noise? So
Yes, there are hot
my
spots
mind. I know,
across.
but I'm keen that we get on that because in the old days of public procurement, the agency would say, "Here's what we want," but actually now. The agency isn't able to say what we want. All it's able to say is, "Here's what our trouble is. Here's what our problem is. Give us an answer." Because they haven't got the vocabulary, and the specialism, and the one I always quote, because I think it's good business. I didn't know on Adobe Photoshop. I never wrote to Adobe and said, "You know, I'd really like to change the sky in my pictures," because I didn't know I wanted to, right? But when they offered it to me for free. I said, "Good, I'll have that," and I liked it. And now I like changing the sky in my photos. And when at the end of the year they said that's another £20 a month a year, I said, "Yeah, I'll pay." So there's a case where the inventor gave you something you didn't know you needed, and once you got yourself hooked on it and found that you did need it because it helped you in your job or you helped you in your business, whatever, then you were happy to pay for it. And that's the place I'd quite like to get to because I think there's a load of technical innovation bubbling around about highway management, traffic flows, condition of the highway. I mean, one that's burning with me at the moment, I've got people talking to me about whether they can use technology, perhaps attached to vehicles, that could be reporting on the state of the highway maintenance. Isn't that just great?
And I've been picking up something similar from, another entrepreneur in London who has successful transport businesses who's got these ideas and has been trying to work out who do I talk to at TfL, who do I talk to at the DfT. So there's such innovation out there and ideas. It's you're right. How do you get it into some sort of public procurement? Which is why I think having some space for innovation and trialing things is hopefully the way forward. And I'm hoping this noise on the tube issue will potentially get resolved, or at least some creative solutions found just by talking to the world really about it.
The other one I want you to fix, my biggest bugbear at the moment, I'm talking about journey planners, which are, there are proprietary ones and there are ones provided by the train operating companies and transport agencies and so on, where they're giving you end-to-end journey, but it's not optimized for you, it's optimized for the commission they get from the third-party suppliers.
Interesting.
So, for example, I've got to be really careful since Claire Mann is coming to TfL, but this is a South West Railway one, which to their great credit they fixed. But if you want the first off-peak train from Waterloo to the Isle of Wight, it always puts you on the ferry at Portsmouth because they get a better commission from the ferry people than the hovercraft. If you force it to put you on the hovercraft, because South Sea Hoverport is a rail destination, the train disappears. It doesn't offer you the train anymore. And that's because it wants to put you on the ferry if it possibly can. So I do think that should be outlawed. I think journey planners provided by everybody, including the public sector, ought to optimize the journey for the passenger, not the income from the third-party providers. SWR, you fixed it. Please don't write to me.
But
Bless you.
others haven't yet.
But there's plenty of other examples.
I think what I think has been a game changer is TfL and other operators, the open data they put out there to allow innovation of apps. Clearly, there's some perverse incentives in there which need to be ironed out, which I hadn't picked up. The one thing I think, though, from the private sector is it would be helpful for organisations like TfL and other transport authorities in terms of their planning to understand how passengers are using that data to be able to look at what journeys people are requesting that aren't straightforward. So that they can look at that in terms of future planning. And I kind of think almost in return for that open data, it would be good to be able to provide some anonymized data back to help with that wider strategic planning. And we've pushed TfL on that in the past and they didn't want to go down that route. But I think that's, in return for us giving you this, which you make money out of, actually just helping us with our wider strategic planning would be helpful.
Lunch with Leon, in association with Passenger Transport magazine. Check out passengertransport.co.uk.
Now, the other one that you got, which I wouldn't give you, which is more express orbital bus services.
Well, it's happening. Yeah, but they're kind of just rebranded existing buses. It's not really what we have after, but we'll see how it works. See how it works.
I mean, you know, the reason I was never convinced was that, frankly, I didn't fully believe that somebody who got fed up with going to Marks and Spencer's in Kingston would get the bus to go to Marks and Spencer's in Sutton, because many high streets are the same, and therefore, why would you go to one as opposed to another? Where I wish they would get it sorted is the journey time, because when we say express, we don't mean they go fast. We mean they don't serve all the stops.
Exactly.
What you really want them to do is to go quickly, because orbital movements often replace a pair of radial movement, where you go up to somewhere and then come down again, as indeed I was doing yesterday. For me, it's half a job, because what I'd like to see is the journey times.
Well, you have to put the bus lanes in, and then that's controversial. But actually, the only way to make express bus routes work is to have dedicated lanes, which takes out road space and some bits of the highway. I think it probably isn't possible, probably particularly around somewhere around the South Circular. But I mean, I think it's a great idea in the sense that I do think some people might live one place and work somewhere else. And actually, at the moment, they hop in their car in Outer London and go, and actually being able to hop on a reliable fast bus would be good. But, we need to see the data on this super loop. I'm not sure I would call it super, but, let's see what it is in practice. But actually, there have been cuts to bus mileage right across London. And I think if you want to get people out of their cars, particularly in outer London, it's got to be a really good offer. And I was really keen on demand responsive buses. There was a pilot in Sutton, you will remember. Yeah, the one in Sutton, I particularly know more about working with our councillors there. And they said, actually, A, it was really popular. And I used it a few times when I was down there, really just to test it out. But it had a different demographic of people using it. And actually, people with learning difficulties were using it rather than because they didn't have the confidence to use a regular bus, but they felt very comfortable using that. And I think we have got to think where that sort of service might play a role in Outer London, for those journeys to get people out of their car, but it's something that's equally convenient. So I think we need to think quite creatively in that space as well.
I know the economics of demand responsive are awful, of course, because it's a bit like, as we used to say, it's a bit like the horse bus. When you're busy, you've only got 12 seats. And when you're quiet, you've still got to feed the horse. And and the fact is, on a little bus, the proportion of the cost that is the driver is so much higher than on a conventional bus. And therefore, you'd have to be pretty busy all of the day in order to get somewhere near breaking even on it. And of course, COVID did for the demand responsive trials, didn't it?
No, absolutely. Of course it did. But I think there is something there. Mm. Yes, I understand what you're saying about the economics, but equally, if your objective is cleaning up air and getting vehicles off the road and to improve journey times, then it might achieve another objective. And the bus services are subsidised in London, as we know.
By several hundred millions of pounds.
We don't cover themselves, and we don't at any point think, oh, we shouldn't do that. So I think in some parts of London, we might need to look at some sort of different mix in order to, say, help get people out of their cars.
One of my biggest baptisms of fire when you and I were working together, when I was in TfL, was what Dial-A-Ride does for the community. Yeah. Because I didn't realise that large numbers of Dial-A-Ride users are using the service partially to have social inclusion, to be able to meet other people. So despite Andrew Boff protesting loudly, I really tried to prove to him that people didn't mind a longish journey to the supermarket, because in fact the journey on the bus was part of their social,
exactly,
meeting their
right,
friends and talking to others and so on. And even if they're only going for a loaf of bread, what Dial-A-Ride was doing was allowing people to go for medical appointments that otherwise would have been a house call by a doctor or a nurse, allowing them to go shopping where social services might have had to have delivered it. And so this was getting broadly housebound people out of their homes and into society simply by providing them with a demand responsive bus. And the second baptism of fire, because I was always being lobbied that the taxis could do this, But the fact is, dial a ride is proper door to door. Like
Yeah,
the
it's
driver will lock your front door for you and carry your bag, help you onto the bus. When you get home, take your shopping and drop it in the hall for you and give you your keys. That's door to door, not curb to curb, which is what otherwise is on offer. And I'm pleased to see that it continues to thrive, because I think dial a ride is one of the it's an unsung social service inside London, which I think is brilliant.
completely. And I have always really championed dial a ride. In fact, I was just trying to see if I could find my notes on it. I recently had a meeting about it because there have been some issues as they've moved to a new provider of their software and so on. And I was looking for the figure, which I can't find. But when I chatted to the management of dial a ride recently, there's been a huge reduction in the number of places they go to because so many social clubs have closed since the pandemic, which I found really upsetting. I can't find the figure, but it was huge. And I said that actually they need to be working with the boroughs to promote in the magazine that goes out to users. Here are how you can find out about other social clubs. Here are the, because I think I know from talking to older people that their lives have got smaller, and so many people are choosing hardly to go out now, partly because the things they used to go to have all closed. So I think there's a wider role there for TfL beyond transport. And I've sort of pushed them and asked the mayor as well to look at this, because I think there is that important role about social interaction. And I was on a BBC London Sunday Politics show a month or so ago, and the topic was loneliness. And they had been out on the street, the journalists, and they spoke to this lady, and she said, "You know, my daughter lives miles away. I've got hardly any friends. I'm out at the shop, something to do." And then she started crying, and it was absolutely heartbreaking. And there are so many Londoners like that who pop to the shops in the morning because it's actually some sort of social interaction. They get to speak to someone, otherwise they can go for days without. So it's really important. And dial a ride may well be a costly service as well, but it provides something far beyond that door-to-door service. So it's really important. And sometimes I think it's a bit of a Cinderella service. It's not seen as very sexy, but actually it's vital.
Yeah. If there was a fundamental problem in this country, it is that sadly, transport in its widest sense helps people in education, it helps in NHS, it helps in social services, and so on. But the drawback, all the cost is in transport, and all the benefits are in social services and education, and so on. A fundamental government problem is that anything that spans more than one government department is always going to be a nuisance. Because to transport, to TfL, to the Department for Transport, it's a dead cost. The fact are there are fewer GPs doing home visits, fewer visits by social services. There are people getting to school or education or whatever. All the benefits are in society, and all the cost is in transport. And as a result of which, we end up in the transport budget with no way to measure the benefit to society of all the stuff that transport does in any meaningful way, other than at, the broadest level. And I think that's a drawback, isn't it?
The drawback of everything, you know, when you look at social services and the health service, and you look at everything, you know, you invest in one place and one budget, but actually it saves money and improves the service overall. So you're quite right. And I think that's one of the issues going forward with transport. You look at High Speed 2, which has been, you know, cut. I hope that might change with the if there's a change of government, but you know, so short-sighted that actually major infrastructure needs serious investment. And at the moment in London, where are our next projects? Where are they? Where is, you know, we haven't Crossrail, thank goodness at last open. We haven't got the Bakerloo line extension. We haven't got Crossrail 2. You know, they're now on a DLR extension down to South East London, all these things, but nothing is, you
Well,
know, spades in the ground. There's no funding for them. You know, that really worries me.
these all feel to me to be wiggly lines drawn on a map in order to keep people interested, with not the slightest thought about where the money's going to come from to
And
do.
actually, my final question that I asked the mayor was around devolution, but it was about whether he would look at a third finance commission. If you recall, Tony Travers at the LSE did a London Finance Commission under Boris, looking at how we could, at a devolved institution, raise funds in different ways, what could be devolved to us. We then did a Mark II in 2017. I said the time has come to do another one, looking at how do we fund infrastructure going forward, because we've got a new government probably at some point, we need to put a case them. This is what London and the other devolved institutions need so we can invest.
I wish I'd had this conversation with you before your last mayor's question time, because the other one I would really have hoped to have challenged him on was the need for a commissioner for the River Thames. Don't we need somebody to promote the river for freight, for passengers, for tourism, for waste, and all that? Don't we desperately need a river commissioner?
Completely, and it's something my committee's called for many times, and I've been a huge champion of the river and the Thames Clippers. I'm a huge fan of, and Sean and the team, and I know you're involved with them as well now, Liam. But I've worked with them over many years. In fact, before I was elected to the Assembly as a Southwark councillor, because oops, we have the river along the north boundary, so really important. And it is increasing, but it has the potential to be another tube line in London, like the Hammersmith and City. So I think it's really important to improve that for passengers. But then, as you say, freight, absolutely.
So, Caroline, we're going to miss you from the London Assembly. I suspect the mayor will miss you in a different way to some of us, because you've been forensic with your questioning on some of those occasions. So I know we're going to miss you, but you're not just going to stay at home with your feet up, are you? You're going to be active out there doing stuff. We can't necessarily talk too much about what that might be. This is not goodbye, is it?
Oh, absolutely not. This is just end of elected service. I think 26 years to have been elected is long enough. Let's have some fresh blood in. But also, I want a new challenge. So I'm, looking to see what I can do, where I can add value with all the knowledge and skills I have. And I have nothing planned as such yet, apart from a couple of holidays, but I'm just seeing what's out there. But I'm looking forward to that. And yeah, the mayor and his office will be relieved. I think I've asked 8,000 odd questions since I've been elected, more than any other member. So I think they will be relieved that I'm not going to be back after May.
Yes, 8,000 questions and about 200 answers. So,
But it's interesting, the answers that were coming through, they always try to clear the huge backlog at the end of the term. And my office was saying, this doesn't actually answer the question we asked. I said, no, but they've ticked their box, they've answered it.
So, I mean, Caroline, we will miss you, as I said, from the London Assembly, but I know that you and I will have more conversations like this one, sometimes in private, sometimes on air, because you won't be disappearing from the London scene, and you will be somewhere, somehow, exerting your considerable influence on making London a better place, because you've always been a champion for safety, always been a champion for transport. I don't suppose you've changed your mind on the expansion of London airports either. So I know you'll be out there championing the cause. And so it's been a great privilege to work with you, Caroline. I look forward to make.
Likewise yourself, it's been wonderful. And all of TfL, it's and the talks in London, I enjoy working with everyone and improving what we can for Londoners, because that's what it's all about.
Indeed, indeed. And you're much too young to retire, but I can promise you that even in retirement, you can still go around causing trouble like I do. So I'm very pleased with that. So
I shall
bless you
join
for.
you on that mission.
So bless you for coming on the show. I know all of my listeners will be thrilled to hear, Caroline, from you, and to know that this is just a change of job, as opposed to not. Thank you for coming on here. This has been Lunch with Leon, which is produced in association with Passenger Transport Magazine. Passengertransport.co.uk is where you need to go for information about everything you need to know about transport in the United Kingdom. So in the meantime, all that's left for me to do is to send a very big thank you to my guest, Caroline Pidgeon, and look forward to seeing you all next time. Thanks, Caroline.
Thank you.